I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory.
We need somebody that literally will take this country and make it great again.
Make America Great Again, Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign slogan, has become synonymous with his entire political movement. MAGA, the acronym, is now a catchphrase used for Trump's most ardent supporters. Emblazoned on millions of red hats, which Trump himself helped promote, the Make America Great Again slogan lived on even after Trump's defeat in the 2020 presidential elections. With its clear reference to better times in the past, what does Make America Great Again actually refer to? How do Trump's supporters and opponents understand the slogan? What does it reveal about how Americans understand their national past? To answer these and other questions, I'm very pleased to welcome historian Matthew Rowley to discuss his book, Trump and the Protestant Reaction to Make America Great Again. Matt, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you.
So the big overarching theme of your book is that Americans don't have a shared memory. And this is one of the reasons why we're so divided. We just don't have this common narrative that we can fall back on to agree on things. And you try to explain that by looking at the writings of a whole range of different Protestants, from conservatives to progressives. So you highlight the ways in which we're divided, and then you offer some possible solutions by looking at those same people. So just to begin with, well, why does this matter? Why does it matter that we don't have a shared memory? Why is having such a shared memory so important? What would it offer?
Our fears in the present and our hopes for the future are really intimately tied in with how we view the past, right? Where we are going, where we hope to go, and what we fear and hope for in the present are linked with where we think we've been. And so the battles over the future of the country really take place as the proxy war is fought in the past, and people are fighting about how we should remember or forget or weigh historical justices. Have we made any progress? Are we stuck back, at some moment in the past? So people are fighting about political things in the present, but they want to enlist the past in their present battles. So I was looking at how they try to do that. What do different groups with different agendas in the present say about the American past? And I really found a lot of divided memories about that. Everybody wants to talk about the past. There's actually that common saying that the past is a foreign country. Well, the past is a foreign country. The left and the right like to vacation there, but they don't like bumping into each other on the beach. They have very different memories about the lessons that we should draw from American history. And so that's really what this book is exploring. If we are going to try to have the pursuit of justice and equality in the present be a bipartisan thing, we need more agreement about what happened in the past and how and why those events happened.
So if we don't want to bump into each other on the beach, well, we're still on the same American cruise ship, right?
So we
still have to chart a common course, right? It's hard to know where you're going if you don't have any common reference points to the past. And I think you start off writing, a lot of emphasis here is on the colonial past, on the Puritans in particular. And as a New Englander, I'm interested in that. So you start off your book with lots of examples at how the left and the right leverage this New England past and how it offers, how it really reveals how differently we see our history. So in what ways do you use that colonial past to highlight how divided we are?
Yeah, so I'm a historian of colonial, of Puritanism more broadly. And more specifically, I wrote my PhD on the worst moments of Puritanism. So violence, massacre, war, all the moments that the Puritans probably would have preferred to stay in the closet. That's what I wrote my PhD on. And you would think that the narratives would just be simple, that, one political party like the Republicans might love the Puritans because they are care about God, care about the family, other things like that. And Democrats would hate the Puritans. But in reality, both sides pull different things out of Puritans themselves. And so the Puritans, according to one left-leaning author, Marilyn Robinson, she argues that the Puritans were the, quote, the most progressive people on earth at the time. And you can find all sorts of themes within Puritanism that that lead towards greater expansion of rights, greater representation, limits on governments, more equal marriage, other things like that that might be associated more with progressivism. But then the right has plenty that they can draw on in Puritanism, ideas of a covenant with God and a Christian nation and having laws reflect God and other things like that. And so the left and the right can both go back to these exact same people. And the reality is the Puritans were incredibly complex. They were really extraordinary people who, just an immense amount of new political ideas came out of this movement called Puritanism. And some of those ideas are really convenient for the right and some are really convenient for the left. And so I just kind of started out the book looking at colonial America. It's framed in terms of Republicans love the past, Democrats hate it. And so just from the very beginning, I wanted to try to complicate that and show that both actually like talking about the American past, they just find in the exact same people very different lessons for the present.
And so you're taking an example of how they can look at the same past and find elements of it that they can look at fondly.
Yes.
Whether it's a progressive narrative or whether it's a religious connection to the origins of the country, or they can look at that past and find negative examples, right? They can point to extremism to try to connect one side or the other to that past. And, you know, we hear the expression witch hunt all the time,
yes,
but that's,
yes,
that's a connection to that particular past. And it's a way of trying to discredit one side through the use of history.
Yes. And I give the example in the book, the Great Awakening, right? That when the right is denigrating, quote unquote, woke culture, right? They reach for the Puritan example of the Great Awakening and call it the Great Awakening, or as you say, witch hunts. So much of the debate about cancel culture and about woke culture uses the language of purity. The language of purity is everywhere in it, whether you support it or oppose it. And so much of that language of purity explicitly goes back to the Puritans, who were, had a few things to say about purity.
So you take, you're looking at this spectrum of Protestant thinkers, you're looking at their writings, and you divide them up into three different camps. So what are these three camps that you identify?
Yes, the first one is not very original. I call it the Make America Great Again group. And the reason why I'm using Make America Great Again as my window into views of history is because Trump's 2016 slogan is a historical claim. Right, that last word again means that America was great and that it will be great again under Trump. So Trump put history front and center in his slogan. So I'm really examining what does that word again mean to different groups of American Protestants. So the first group I put down, Make America Great Again Protestants, and they roughly identify a great America as somewhere between, well, there's a lot of ways to look at it. Some of them talk very fondly about the period from 1620 up to like the 1950s. And they really like Reagan, and they tend to agree that the year 2000 was the best year. So 2000 being right at the end of Clinton, right at the beginning of Bush, and right before 9/11. So they've got really complex views of how they're viewing history. So that's the Make America Great Again group. The second group of Protestants that I identify, Make America Lament. So instead of trying to restore some kind of past greatness, this group wants to lament all the negative things that have happened in history. So especially the theft of land from American Indians, slavery, and second-class citizenship for women, and also lack of LGBTQ rights. And this group kind of identifies progress as starting in the 1950s. And surprisingly, Democrats also think that 2000 was the best year as well. So there's actually quite a bit of agreement on when people were asked, I think in 2015 or 2016, what was the best year? Both Protestants, both Democrats and Republicans kind of hit on the year 2000. And I do think that terrorism in the U.S. Radically reshaped fears, hopes, memories, all of those things as well. But that's a whole nother discussion. So first group, Make America Great Again, wants to restore some kind of past greatness, kind of in the 1950s mold. Make America Lament wants to move beyond the worst moments in American history. And so progress for them comes through shedding the past, through throwing off the past. And then a third group, the phrase was not original to me. I note in the book who it came from, Make America Better. And this group, I argue, goes beyond the lament position. So they start with lamenting land theft, lamenting slavery, lamenting second-class citizenship for women. But they go beyond that lamentation, and they kind of return back around to what went right in American history, right? What are the things that worked well? If the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were written for white landholding, slaveholding males, those documents also produced a logic that helped undo slavery. And so this third group almost loops back to the best in American history and says that we need to recover what is best in American history if we are going to have justice and equality in the present. So just to recap, but phrase it a little bit differently, when you're reading a Protestant in the Make America Great Again category, it's generally an entire book about how great American history is, with one paragraph on land theft, slavery, and second-class citizenship. If you're reading a book in the Make America Lament category, it's, you know, the entire book is about all that's gone wrong in American history. And then there's one paragraph that's almost saying, oh, yeah, and we did some things right. And then that third group, the Make America Better group of Protestants, is constantly going between the best. You know, it was good, but we fell short, and things got better, but we took a step back. And it's just this continual back and forth in that type of writing. Where they're acknowledging at the same time what went wrong and what went right in history.
But you point out, too, if you take the Make America Great Again and the Make America Lament Again camp, that there are a lot of similarities, right? That there's this lack of confidence, it seems like, on each side. Yeah. There's a shared pessimism about the nation, and there's also this lack of confidence that you could have a more well-rounded approach to the past, right? It's like the country isn't able to handle that.
Yeah, well, it's almost the sense. So on the Make America Great Again side, those people, it's almost as if you can hear the gears in their head turning, and they're saying, "Oh, if we spend too much time focusing on what went wrong, then you know, all of a sudden, every statue in America is going to be knocked down," and then the Make America Lament group is saying, you know, oh, if we focus too much on what went right, then we're going to have KKK groups, you know, hanging out at the Capitol. And they've kind of got these like worst case scenarios that if we have a nuanced view of history, we're going to end up at that awful extreme version. And so what they do is they largely just bracket out what is inconvenient to their narrative. right? They acknowledge often in one paragraph, yeah, America's got some bad things that they should be embarrassed about. But the entire narrative for Make America Great Again Protestant is good. You know, it was, and the opposite for Make America Lament, right? They do acknowledge that, you know, wow, this is one of the best countries on earth to live in. We're doing some things right, but let's talk for 100 pages about slavery and land theft and other things like that, because both groups are afraid that if they acknowledge the other side, that will be taken as discrediting what they care about.
So it's almost like a lack of confidence in the maturity of people, their ability to be able to handle the facts.
Yeah, and that's where Susan Neiman comes in so helpful on this point. And I think it might be the last paragraph or last sentence of my book. I say something to the effect of mature nations face up to their past, right? It's a sign of maturity that you can own the good and own the bad at the same time. That you can look back and say, we got a lot of things right as a nation. There's a lot of things that, you know, for centuries we got wrong. And that's actually a sign of maturity. It's a very fragile view of history that can be completely undone by acknowledging the other side. There's really not much confidence, as you're putting it in terms of confidence, and I think that's helpful. There's not a lot of confidence in either of those camps. Maybe it's a lack of confidence in the ability of readers or the general public to be able to hold a complex view of history in their mind. But I tend to think that people can actually handle that. And also, I think that part of that lack of confidence comes from the fact that views of history are so tightly linked with support for candidates, right? So a Republican says, you know, they might in the back of their mind say, oh, if I really grieve slavery, then that means I'd have to vote Democrat. And, you know, the Democratic candidate were to say, oh, if I actually took pride in some of the things my nation did, then, you know, now I'm starting to sound Republican.
I'm going to have to put a Make America Great Again banner on my house.
And I think that we have such a tight linking between how we view history and how we vote. And in some ways that's fine, right? That's a normal thing because you vote for a candidate based on where you think the country's been and where you want the country to go. But it's a very insecure way of viewing history. You know, oh, to admit anything on the other side means my party is invalid. And that's just not true.
So one of the themes in the news now is the difficulty of Donald Trump staying on message, right? It's like he seems to be his own worst enemy, right? He doesn't really know how to play his best hand. He keeps shooting himself in the foot. So if you're trying to look at how clear Donald Trump is, to what extent does he stay on message about when America was great, or what Make America Great Again means? And you're looking at his speeches, you're looking at his books. I mean, how clear does he make it? How consistent does he package that?
One of the most helpful analyses of Trump's language, I discuss the book at length in my book, But it's looking at how he communicates. And the author of that book says essentially that you need to, when you're listening to Trump speak, you need to imagine that you're sitting in a bar and having a conversation, you know, like some guy is drinking pints and telling a good story. That essentially is Trump's mode of communication. He's the guy in the bar who's telling a good story, an engaging story about where America's been, where it's going. And that story, in a lot of ways, is a story of, you know, immigrants who are coming in the southern border, white working class males whose jobs have gone overseas. And he's telling this good story. And imagine that you're sitting in a pub and there's a really, really good storyteller. And then a fact checker comes in, right? Fact checker from the Washington Post or something like that. And they keep stopping the story in the pub every couple of minutes and say, well, that's not quite true. That's not quite true. That would actually ruin the experience of the storytelling because you're constantly interrupting it with facts. And in one of Trump's books, he says, quote, that he communicates by quote, truthful hyperbole. So take that how you want, right? He overstates stuff, but it's fine that he overstates it because it's a good story. It tells, you know, people resonate with it. He communicates by truthful hyperbole. That's what he claims. And in one of his books, I actually think this is one of the truest statements Trump has ever said. He said, "I am not a historian, let alone a distinguished historian." The reality is he doesn't care that much about history. He talks a lot about American greatness. He talks about protecting history, but he almost never mentions any details. So the person he talks about the most is Ronald Reagan. And that is in a lot of ways, it seems as if that is what his restoration is about. So Trump talks about history, doesn't give any details, but everybody else fills in those details, right? It's everybody else who is responding to that and trying to figure out, well, what is this America that Trump wants to restore? Is it the KKK version of America? Is it the progressive rights for women America? Is it the theocracy America? What is wrapped up in this version of, again, make America great again? And I think Trump is intentionally vague on that point. I think he doesn't really want to specify. I don't even know how much he knows of American history. To him, I don't think that it's that much of a concern. And so he's intentionally vague, but it leaves everybody else in culture saying, what does this mean?
Okay. That part I thought was really interesting and almost hilarious that you have this bigger than life theme that refers to the past. There's so much that swirls around that. But then you point out Trump himself actually talks a lot less about history, spends a lot less time than all of his predecessors. It doesn't seem to be that important to him.
Yes.
Okay. But if people disagree, and I don't know whether this is would you say this is somebody who isn't staying on message? If people sometimes see the way he packages that slogan as inclusive or exclusive, is that because of him or is it just because it's vague or he tells the story to a different crowd in whatever pub he happens to be in? It could be one crowd or a different crowd.
Well, and I think that Trump, like any candidate, tailors his message to the audience. And if you, so throughout much of his campaigning, even through much of his presidency, Trump continued to hold rallies where he's talking to largely white and largely male audiences. And Make America Great Again, when you listen to those rallies, Make America Great Again sounds like Make America Great Again for white males, right? That's kind of the exclusive interpretation. At the same time, Trump is holding rallies in churches across the country, and these church rallies are not getting a lot of national attention. And they are with a particular sliver of the American Christian Protestant community, the New Apostolic Reformation. And those rallies are featuring prophecy, miracles, other things like that, laying on of hands. Those rallies are heavily minority and heavily female run. And so Trump has these two different sides of him. If you look at his public rallies that CNN shows up to, mostly white, mostly male, Make America Great Again for white males. If you look at his religious rallies that he holds, these are in churches, largely minorities, heavily female ministers, and there's the implied Make America Great Again for all. And so you really do have these two different interpretations, even even within the Trump supporting camp, where I think both of them, both of these different groups can look at that slogan as inclusive or exclusive, depending on which version of Trump they are hearing at any given time.
Well, that's interesting. So there is some fairness to this gripe that Trump has that the media doesn't cover him in a balanced way. That's one example of how there's some truth to that.
Well, and you look at Trump has surrounded himself with I've written several scholarly articles on this group of prophets. Trump has surrounded himself with a group of Protestant prophets who claim to hear direct words from God. And they've been in the White House many times. They spoke at his inauguration. They open most of his rallies. So like Trump will hop up before Trump hops on stage, especially in 2016, it was usually a black minister who got on before him, part of this like prophetic group. And so Trump is surrounding himself with women in ministry and surrounding himself with minorities in ministry. And that provides, I don't know why Trump is doing that. I think he likes to hear that he's God's chosen, which is what they're telling him. But it insulates him from the charge of sexism and racism, right? How could he possibly be sexist and racist when his spiritual advisor is a woman, when the minister who opens all of his rallies is an African American minister, right? When the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is one of his most vocal supporters, right? How can he possibly be racist when those are the people he's surrounding himself with? And he really is surrounding himself with them. But the media doesn't really pick up on it. They mostly only pay attention to his political rallies and ignore the religious rallies in support of him.
So if we turn to this first camp and try to unpack that a little bit, the Make America Great Again slogan and how Protestants on the right understand this, you stress that they relate to it to a large degree in terms of a long list of grievances and this understanding of how the country has been going downhill for a long time, that it's lost its way, and how Make America Great Again could be translated maybe in their minds as Make America Christian Again, and they see him as someone who can advance that agenda. Although you point out that at the beginning, at least, conservative Protestants weren't that excited about him. Seems like this was not an immediate idea that this was somebody who could really work to advance their interests. But if you're trying to stress, well, conservative Protestants understand Make America Again in terms of a list of grievances, well, what are those grievances? In what ways has the country lost its way?
So you're right, and I'm glad you bring up that idea of Protestants largely rejecting him initially, conservative Protestants. It's pretty much impossible, at least in 2015 to maybe 2019, pretty impossible to get a pro-Trump book published with any of the major publishers. Almost every seminary came out against Trump in one way or another, the major seminaries, and highlighted him as a danger to the faith. National Association of Evangelicals had some very harsh words for Trump. Now most of them eventually warmed up to him, and essentially it was a bargain, right? Hillary will mock you. Trump will protect you. They initially did not think that he was a godly man. They thought that he was a protector, a strong man. And that's the thing that in a lot of ways warmed up conservative evangelicals to Trump. But you're right, they do. They carry around this story of grievances. Where did America go wrong? And we start with the 1950s with the Johnson Amendment that meant that politics and religion were not supposed to mix in certain ways according to the tax law. Engel v. Vitale then outlaws prayers in public schools. Abington v. Shemp outlawed Bible reading in public schools. Roe v. Wade allowed for abortion rights. And then rights for same-sex couples were extended in Romer v. Evans in 1996 and Obergefell v. Hodge in 2015. So if you imagine Make America Great Again Protestants as carrying around a backpack, and that backpack has grievances in it, right? They're lugging this backpack around. They really would like to get rid of this backpack. But it's got all of these court cases that they identified the 1950s as a point of departure, as a departure into an ungodly America. So they would say, we were godly from the 1620s. We made a covenant with God at that time. And then in the 1950s, started moving away from God. And now, you know, whatever culture war thing they're fighting about today, that's the result of 1954 Johnson Amendment. And so Protestants want to unload this burden that they carry with them. And they looked at Trump as somebody who would help them to unload that. And you can see some of that being undone in the years since Trump was elected.
Okay, so if the country has become more permissive through all these legal changes that have happened since the 1950s that make people feel like this is a country they don't recognize anymore, that's it's become detached from its Christian heritage. You point out that the left is identified as the culprit, but then at the same time, so the left is resented for ushering in these changes, but the left is also resented as being the judge and the culprit and the judge of the people who end up getting victimized. And if people feel victimized, they're incensed even more because they feel like they're mocked for their own feelings of being victimized.
Yes. And that's one of the things that I try to, as best I can, if I have somebody on the left reading my book, I'm thinking, how can I best help them to climb into the head of somebody in the MAGA group? Or if I have someone on the right reading my book, how can I best help them to, you know, understand the Make America Lament position? And that sense of victimization and gaslighting is really essential to this. So progressives will constantly say, yay, we've made such progress, you know, and they will be championing all the progress that's been made in the last couple of years. And when the right says, let's roll back some of this quote unquote progress, the left says, you're trying to change America. And they had just celebrated like 5 seconds earlier how they changed America, right? How they moved America away from the historical version. And then they portray the right as the ones that are changing it. Now, of course, the right is being regressive. They're trying to pull back on these things. But the right is responding as those who have been tricked out of it. So slippery slope arguments, it's often said that they're not valid. Sometimes slippery slope arguments are valid, right? They're really, like, you look at history, if you allow eugenics, maybe you'll allow gas chambers. You know, there really are slippery slopes in history, and they can really lead to some very disturbing places. Well, in the 1950s, conservatives made slippery slope arguments. If you allow this, then we will end up with this, then we will end up with this, and end up with this. And in the 1950s, they were told, you're paranoid. This will never happen. Don't worry. We're not going to do this. You know, there will never be a day when Christians are being hauled into court for X, Y, or Z. Well, from the right's perspective, that slippery slope argument was prophetic. And so they feel as if they were tricked out of putting up a fight in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And then now they're appearing in court. And then magically Trump comes on the scene and, you know, promises, I've got a quote in the book of his, you know, essentially Trump promises, the day I come into office, Christians will stop being dragged into court for their beliefs. And to many on the right, that was an incredibly attractive offer. They felt as if they had been tricked into giving up legal rights for Christianity. And And now they were wanting a protector who would roll back the clock.
Yeah, and if there's the greatest legacy of Trump's administration is the dramatic changes to the Supreme Court, all the federal judges that were appointed. So he does become the significant supporter of that segment of the population.
Yeah, so a lot of them feel, you know, as we're coming around to Trump's third attempt for another term, right, they feel as if that bargain paid off. That you know, you do this for me, I do this for you. They feel as if he actually was a good protector of them. And so a lot of them are willing to take a gamble on him again.
And you mentioned the Protestant prophets, they see him as a modern day Cyrus, right?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, so I've written two different articles just on the prophets, and they're especially in their relation to the Capitol insurrection, because they were much of the impetus behind the Stop the Steal movement. And the prophets, they start prophesying about Donald Trump in 2011. You can go back onto YouTube, time stamped on YouTube. 2011 is when the prophecies about Trump start. And then I think 2014, 2015, prophets start saying that Trump is going to be the next, he's going to save America. It's kind of generic. Then, you know, pretty much all evangelical Protestants are against Trump as the candidate. You know, they'd prefer Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio. But then the prophets start saying that God has decreed that Trump will be president. And they become very vocal about this. And then when Trump knocks out all the other Republican candidates, it's taken as a confirmation, right? And then the prophets start predicting that Trump will, the prophets start predicting that Trump will win, and nobody believes them, and they turn out to be right. And then the prophets in 2019 are predicting a cataclysmic event that will shake the election. A COVID happens. And then the prophets predict that Trump will win the election and it will be stolen from him. And sure enough, they claim, and many of them still claim to this day, that that prophecy was correct, that Trump was really the elected and that it really was stolen from him. And so they identify Trump as a Cyrus figure. Cyrus is a non-Jewish king in the ancient Near East who God used to bless the people of Israel. So Cyrus is not godly, but he's a blessing to God's people. And so the prophets identified Trump as Cyrus, and you can even find coins that have been minted with the face of Cyrus and Trump on them together. So Trump is the ungodly instrument of God. So the prophets who were some of the earliest supporters of Trump in 2015, when nobody else thought he had a chance, the prophets said, we will vote for Trump because God chose Trump, not because they thought Trump was godly. And that's a huge difference between those two things. And so they view him as a Cyrus figure who will bless God's people, not the Jewish people necessarily, although moving the embassy to Israel was all tied in with this, and some of the prophets were there for that event. But that God would bless his second chosen people, the American people, who had a covenant similar to Israel. So they believe that Trump was God's choice, and it had nothing to do with Trump's godliness or ungodliness.
Okay. So if we turn to the Make America Lament Again category, how different is their perspective on the American past? What's the corrective? What do you see there?
So what the America Make America Lament position is doing, and is honestly doing it very well, is it is showing that America never was great for all Americans, right? That is the essential argument. There never was a point in American history where it was great for everybody, right? We might look at the 1860s and say, you know, that was a great moment of moral clarity over the issue of slavery. But the U.S. is going to start launching wars pretty soon against American Indians, right? The very same pen of Abraham Lincoln that signs the Emancipation Proclamation also takes away indigenous rights, right? So these moments where we might want to look back on and say there's greatness there, the Make America Lament position is saying it's much more complicated than that, right? George Washington was a slave owner. He was a slave owner who fudged the laws so that he could keep his slaves. He was a slave owner who took his slaves' teeth. You know, all of these like incredibly squeamish parts of the history. They want to focus our attention on that and say, you know, well, maybe Washington had some good ideas, but it's not really that useful to us to dwell on the things that that George Washington did right, precisely because we live in an America where we have racialized policing and police brutality and poor educational standards for minority children and redlining that keeps minorities from purchasing houses in wealthier neighborhoods. Like, so they would say, what's the point in focusing on the good of George Washington when the bad is continuing to influence 2024 America?
So we have so much that's structurally wrong with the country that has these deep historical roots that we need to confront that, resolve that before there could be any talk of greatness. But you point out how this particular camp also stresses that there's a lot that stands in the way. And confusion, you mentioned this, one example already, that people could have more than one side to them. But there's also a large degree of ignorance. There's an enormous memory gap that you referred to. So if you're going to confront this past, try to work through it, then you've got to deal with the confusion that's out there, the ignorance, the memory gap. So what are these obstacles?
So I think for the Make America Lament group, I think that they know the history, right? I think if you were to ask most of them, for all that you say America got wrong, what country would you want to live in? I think most of them would say, I'd like to live in America, or, maybe list off a couple of other countries that they might want to live in. Like, they know that there are good things to this country, and that those good things have historical roots, right? They're aware of the fact that, our Bill of Rights enshrines rights for minorities and that some countries still don't have bills of rights. But they don't really see much use in dwelling on that side of history, right? They are much more present focused. So they say, when you have an officer on the neck of somebody who's saying that they can't breathe, it's deeply offensive to talk about this being a great country. They try to highlight the fact that the crimes of America are so great that the country itself can never be in the green on the balance sheet, right? How could you weigh a couple hundred years of slavery against something else in the scales, right? Slavery of the indigenous population, of the African population, was such an egregious and sustained wrong that emancipation doesn't even act too much in the balance. At some point in the book, I phrase it in terms of the murder of George Floyd. Is America great? Because it put its knee is America lamentable because it put its knees on the slave, or is it great because it freed the slave? And you have these different views. How do you weigh the crimes of a nation? And I know Susan Neiman talks about this a lot in Learning from the Germans. There really is nothing. Like, what could be given to the Black community, to the Indigenous community, that repairs the wrong of slavery and land theft? Like, it seems crass to even talk in terms of balancing out that sheet.
But isn't one of the challenges for the Make America Lament Again camp the fact that there's this ignorance about what happens in the country after the Civil War up to the Civil Rights Movement? There's a fast forwarding and a skipping over all of that because it doesn't fit into a Coca-Cola commercial.
Yeah. Well, so I think just in general, most Americans, and this again is new, Susan Neiman is the one who alerted me to this. Most Americans have an almost century long gap. You know, what happened between the Emancipation Proclamation and the Montgomery bus boycott? Most Americans don't know Black history or Indigenous history between those windows. And that's really key. A lot of things happened. America took steps forward. America took steps back. But a lot of really key details took place in that hundred, you know, roughly a century there. And so one of the things with the Make America Lament, one of the weaknesses that they are often accused of is that they don't acknowledge progress. If Make America Great Again, people don't acknowledge the failures of the past, don't dwell on the failures, the Make America Lament crowd doesn't acknowledge the progress. So after the murder of George Floyd, you heard a lot of things about how we haven't progressed as a nation. We haven't, it's just as bad to be a minority as it always has been. I'm a white male. I don't know the experience of being a minority, but I've read and I've listened to plenty, including President Obama, who emphasizes that very real progress has been made. There's a long way to go. You know, Obama will be the first to say, using biblical language, we have not reached the promised land yet, but we've been marching through Canaan. And so it's one of those things. We find this also with environmental activism, right? If global warming is so bad that nothing can be done about it, well, then you end up in the present with people being paralyzed. Right. There's no point in me recycling. There's no point in me cutting down on energy if the whole thing's going to be done in 10 years. The same kind of paralyzing happens on the left, where, you know, if American history is one long narrative of nothing changing, why do I think the 2024 election matters?
Is this the criticism on the right, though, that this is you need something more uplifting? Otherwise, you just paralyze the country under this really depressing, weighty story.
I think it's a criticism within the left, too, that the third group of Protestants, the Make America Better ones, and a whole lot of people who aren't Protestant, make that argument that we have to acknowledge we've got a long ways to go, but we've made a lot of progress. And that by telling a story of the things that went right, that's actually where we get the ideas. That's where we get the inspiration, right? How did Martin Luther King Jr. call America to live, to be better, right? He went back to the founding. He went back to what went right. He argued that they were hypocrites, but they wrote some good things that, you know, that can be used to extend rights to people that they never wanted to extend rights to. Calling these documents a promissory note, that, you know, this note was written hundreds of years earlier. It wasn't intended for Black Americans, but Black Americans are claiming these documents of the founders and saying, this is how we move towards greater justice and equality, by reaching for what is best in the past. And so that critique about paralyzing comes from the right, but it also comes within the left. The left is kind of divided into people who think we have made progress and people who think that progress is an illusion. And so that's a fight within the left itself.
Okay. So if we return to this Make America Better Again camp, you argue that it's not a Goldilocks narrative. It's not like a right in between Make America Great Again and Make America Lament, that they're more weighted towards the Make America Lament camp, but they take it further. So how do they go further?
Yeah. So you called it, just very briefly, you called it the Make America Better Again. It's just the Make America Better. And the thing about the word better, it's not original to me there. It's from David N. Moore. The thing about better is that you don't have to decide on the past, right? You don't have to definitively say America is evil or America is good. All that you have to do is say, we're going to push to make it better, right? There's good and bad in the past. We're going to push for better. And so by focusing on improvement, they're able to actually be very bipartisan. The Protestants that I identified in this group, men, women, black, white, left, Democratic, Republican, they come from across the racial spectrum, religious spectrum, because they don't have to tell a simplistic narrative about the past. What they can do is agree that that good and bad happened in the past and try to have a better America. But you're right. I don't frame it as a Goldilocks position. It's not. So the Make America Better crowd isn't saying America isn't as bad as the Democrats say or as good as the Republicans say. It actually pretty much adopts the Make America Lament position and says, you know, really, really bad stuff happened. Not just once in American history, over and over and over again for centuries. And that continues to impact the present. How do we make progress? We make progress by looking at what went right. We make progress by looking at the high ideals of America. Every single organization, every nation has a gap between its ideal and its real. America has a huge gap because we make such high claims about our country. A lot of countries don't even try to pretend that all men or women are created equal, right? Lots of countries don't even pretend that. America put forward that as a proposition to govern by and failed miserably at it. That's the ideal. We are, we're slowly, slowly moving towards that ideal. Kind of entering into that ideal of justice and equality for all. There's a lot of work to do, but by going to the past, we're able to take inspiration from those documents, from those individuals, flawed though they be, and extend the logic in ways that they never would have thought to do.
So if you take the Make America Great Again camp, well, those ideals have been realized. Mission accomplished. You
Mission
can raise,
accomplished.
The, raise the flag on that aircraft carrier.
Right? Yes.
And if you take the America Lament camp, it's hard not to say again. It's just so ingrained in my head. But if you take the Make America Lament camp, we'll never get there, right? There's such a weight, a burden of falling short of those ideals that we're going to be digging ourselves out from this forever. But the Make America Better camp sees a way forward. And I think you point out that history is a big part of the answer, that you have to have a more nuanced understanding of the past. So how does history help us move forward?
Yeah, I think embracing an uncomfortable history is really key. Embracing a history that doesn't fit neatly into left or right narratives. We almost want to say, well, what good is that history? What good is, you know, what good is a history that's complicated and messy? Van Jones uses the word messy truth, and I put Van Jones in this Make America Better group. Well, messiness, right? If we view the past as messy, we are much more likely to view the present as messy, right? If Abraham Lincoln was an individual who could write soaring prose about the injustice of one human enslaving another, he also writes beautiful prose talking about the horror at blacks and whites intermarrying, right? That's one messy individual called Lincoln. Well, the average Trump supporter is messy. The average Biden supporter, Harris now, the average Harris supporter is messy, right? Every one of us as humans has things that we're proud of, things that we're ashamed of. Every political party has things in its past, unless you're like a brand new political party with, you know, no history at all. The Democrats have stood for some reprehensible things in its history. The Republicans have stood for some reprehensible things, right? Neither of the parties are, you know, entirely pure or entirely defiled. And, you know, embracing a complicated past is training for embracing a complicated neighbor.
Matt, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. Matthew Rowley is a visiting assistant professor of history at Fairfield University and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. I've been talking with him today about his book, Trump and the Protestant Reaction to Make America Great Again. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. Word of mouth is always the best way to inform others. I'm Rick Derderian. See you soon.